On Tuesday, July 17, at noon, Truman was working in his study when, as he later recalled, I looked up from the desk and there stood Stalin in the doorway. We had lunch, talked socially, put on a real show drinking toast to everyone, then had pictures made in the backyard. I can deal with Stalin. He is honest, but smart as hell. Over lunch, Burns described their visit to Hitler's headquarters and asked Stalin how he thought Hitler had died. Stalin speculated that the Führer was still alive, in Spain or Argentina. Stalin may have been holding out the possibility that Hitler was still alive and dangerous in order to license harsher measures against Germany. Truman told Stalin that he was very anxious to get the Germans set up in operation so that the Allied Control Council could now govern Germany as a whole. The first formal conference session was at 5 p.m. It was held at the Cecilienhof Palace, built in 1917 before the last German defeat. To demonstrate their equality in a great power minuet, Truman, Stalin, and Churchill entered the room simultaneously through separate doors. Seated with his allies at a burgundy-draped round table, Truman recalled the tragedy of Versailles in 1919. This time, he said, any final German peace conference should be prepared beforehand by the victor powers. He proposed that the groundwork be laid by a council of foreign ministers composed of the Big Three plus France and China. Stalin disagreed. He complained that the French were U.S. lackeys. As for the Chinese, why should they be involved in European problems? Truman and Churchill compromised by excluding the Chinese. Truman proposed that the Allied Control Council should start working immediately. He said on questions affecting Germany as a whole, the Control Council should be paramount. On matters affecting each zone, the zone commander should reign supreme. On Wednesday afternoon, July 18, debate on post-war Germany's borders began. At Yalta, the Big Three had agreed that the Curzon Line, drawn after World War I, would be Poland's eastern border with the Soviet Union. They had also decided that Poland should be compensated with substantial German territory to its west. Stalin felt that Poland deserved all of Germany east of the Oder and Neisse rivers. This would force millions of Germans westward and strip Germany of some of its richest farmland. As far as Stalin was concerned, this was already a fait accompli. He said, Germany is what she has become after the war. But Truman refused to consider the matter settled. He said, why not say Germany as she was before the war in 1937? Stalin disagreed. He said, as she is in 1945. Truman reminded Stalin that Germany had lost everything in 1945. He said that at Yalta, the Big Three had agreed to defer such questions until a final peace conference on Germany. Truman was impatient. He wrote in his diary, I'm not going to stay around this terrible place all summer just to listen to speeches. I'll go home to the Senate for that. On Friday, July 20, Truman joined Generals Eisenhower and Bradley to watch the official raising of the Stars and Stripes over the American sector of Berlin. Speaking without notes, Truman told the crowd of American soldiers, we are not fighting for conquest. There is not one piece of territory or one thing of a monetary nature that we want out of this war. Exactly 1 year had passed since Klaus von Stauffenberg's failed plot against Adolf Hitler. If any of the Americans remembered the anniversary, they did not mention it in public. At that moment, they were trying to establish collective guilt for Hitler's horrors, and they didn't wish to confuse the issue by reminding the world that some Germans had risked their lives, however belatedly and for whatever reasons, to stop the Führer. The next day, Henry Stimson brought the president an urgent message. A plutonium implosion bomb had been tested in Alamogordo, New Mexico, 5 days earlier. Stimson reported that the bomb was successful beyond the most optimistic expectations of everyone. Truman told Stimson that the news gave him an entirely new feeling of confidence. He knew that if the United States were now sole owner of a successful atomic bomb, it would be poised to end the Japanese war fast, without Soviet or British help, and exercise American will on the post-war world. That afternoon, Truman complained to Stalin that the Poles had been effectively assigned a zone of Germany without consultation with us. Stalin insisted that giving German land to Poland should be no problem because no Germans were left in the region. Admiral Leahy whispered to Truman, "Of course not, the Bolshies have killed all of them." Churchill noted that 2 or 3 million Germans remain in the area Stalin wanted to give Poland. Removing it from Germany would remove a quarter of Germany's farmland, from which German food and reparations must come. Truman warned that he could not approve Eastern Germany's removal from contributing to the economy of the whole of Germany. He later wrote Bess, "Russia and Poland have gobbled up a big hunk of Germany and want Britain and us to agree. I have flatly refused." Churchill attributed the president's new boldness to the bracing news from Alamogordo.
"We are drifting toward a line down the center of Germany."
As the sole proprietor of the atomic bomb, President Truman had just become the most powerful man the human race had ever known. Truman was still smoldering over Stalin's defense of what Truman called his Bolsheviki land grab. Truman wanted his allies to approve a plan that would do several things: punish the Germans, quash the German ability and yearning to start another global war, and still feed and warm all Europeans. Now, with the atomic weapon in his arsenal, Truman asked Jimmy Burns to put on the pressure to wind up the Potsdam meeting fast. On Monday, July 23, backed by Truman, Burns told Molotov he was deeply concerned about reparations. He said by abruptly handing German territory to Poland, the Soviets had exposed the British and the Americans to serious dangers. Burns suggested that each occupying power simply take reparations from its own zone. Under this plan, if the Soviets wanted certain equipment or materials from other zones, for example, they could trade coal for them. On matters like currency and transportation, the Allied Control Council would still govern Germany as an economic whole. Molotov was shocked by the sudden danger that the Anglo-Americans might offer no reparations at all. He warned that Stalin strongly favored an overall reparations plan. On Wednesday, July 25, Stalin told Truman and Churchill that if the Ruhr remains a part of Germany, it must supply the whole of Germany. The Americans blanched. Charles Bohlen of the U.S. privately warned that Stalin would use such a privilege to paralyze the German economy and push Germany toward communism. The Potsdam Conference recessed while Churchill returned to London to await announcement of the results of the British election. In the meantime, Truman flew to Frankfurt. There he called on Eisenhower. The general was lodged in the former headquarters of IG Farben, one of the German war-making enterprises investigated by Senator Truman during the war. Truman wrote his mother and sister, "The big towns like Frankfurt and Darmstadt were destroyed, but the small ones are intact. It is awful to see what the bombs did to the towns, railroads, and bridges. To think that millions of Russians, Poles, English, and Americans were slaughtered, all for the folly of one crazy egotist by the name of Hitler. I hope it won't happen again." In London, Churchill got bad news. Despite his role in the European victory, British voters, now focused on domestic problems, had turned out his Conservative Party. The Prime Minister's aides complained of their people's ingratitude. Churchill was despondent, but he replied paternally. He said, "I wouldn't call it that. They have had a very hard time." On Sunday, July 29, Molotov told Burns that his reparations proposal was acceptable in principle. But contrary to Burns' claim, he said, the Soviet zone contained only about 42% of German wealth. Therefore, the Soviet Union deserved about 8% from other zones, including $2 billion worth of industrial equipment from the Ruhr. Burns replied that his experts thought it was impossible to put any specific dollar value on potential reparations. Therefore, he said, the Soviets should have 25% of all equipment available for reparations from the Ruhr. but the Soviets should pay for those machines with coal and other goods from their zone. On Monday, July 30, Burns told Molotov that as a concession, the United States would tolerate for now the Soviet grant of German territory beyond the Oder-Neisse line to Poland. Responding to another Soviet demand, he agreed to bestow diplomatic recognition to the extent possible, he said, on Kremlin-dominated governments in Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Finland. That night, Truman wrote in his diary that the talks were at an impasse. He wrote Bess, "The whole difficulty is reparations. Of course, the Russians are naturally looters, and they have been thoroughly looted by the Germans over and over again, and you can hardly blame them for their attitude. The thing I have to watch is to keep our skirts clean and make no other commitments." The next day, Burns told Molotov that his proposals on diplomatic relations for Eastern Europe, the German land for Poland, and German reparations were a package. He said, "We will agree to all three or none." He said, "As soon as the Soviets reply, the President and I will leave for the United States the next day." That evening, Truman secretly scrawled out formal approval for the first atomic bomb to be dropped on Japan. 3 days after learning of the successful test at Alamogordo, the President had quietly told Stalin that the United States now had an unusually destructive new weapon. Truman could not know that Soviet intelligence had already briefed Stalin on the whole thing. Stalin simply replied to Truman that he hoped the Americans would use the weapon well against Japan. Now, in his written order, Truman specified that the thunderous event should unfold only after he and his party were safely gone from Potsdam. He wrote, "Release when ready, but not sooner than August 2. On Wednesday, August 1, while discussing German assets abroad, Stalin made a fateful suggestion. He spoke to Truman and Britain's new Labour Prime Minister, Clement Attlee, who now took Churchill's place at Potsdam. Stalin proposed that the Soviet Union regard the whole of Western Germany as falling within your sphere and Eastern Germany as within ours. Truman asked whether Stalin meant to establish a line down Europe running from the Baltic to the Adriatic. Stalin said yes. Soon they moved on to talk about war crimes. Stalin was suspicious that the United States would try to curry favor with the Germans, especially big German capitalists. He complained that the Americans were unwilling to publish long lists of German criminals. He said, "Aren't we going to act against any German industrialists? I think we should." As one example, Stalin mentioned the Krupp dynasty, long known for making German arms. He said, "If they will not do, let's name others." The Big Three finally agreed to publish a list of top German war criminals within a month. That evening, Truman, Stalin, and Attlee signed the Potsdam Declaration. It said, "The German people have begun to atone for the terrible crimes committed under the leadership of those whom in the hour of their success they openly approved and blindly obeyed." It said, "The victors do not wish to destroy or enslave the Germans, but to help them prepare for the eventual reconstruction of their life on a peaceful and democratic basis." It said, "Allied policies toward the Germans will be uniform, so far as is practicable. During occupation, Germany shall be treated as a single economic unit. Each occupying power will take reparations from its own zones. Beyond that, the Soviets will take 15% of industrial equipment that is unnecessary for the German peace economy in exchange for food, coal, and other goods. Under the terms, the Soviets would also receive an additional 10% for free." The declaration authorized the Council of Foreign Ministers to draft a peace treaty to be accepted by the government of Germany when a government adequate for that purpose is established. All three leaders signed the document. Then Truman pronounced the conference adjourned, he said, until our next meeting, which I hope will be in Washington. Stalin smiled and said, "God willing." Truman wrote his mother, "You never saw such pig-headed people as are the Russians. I hope I never have to hold another conference with them, but of course I will." In this, Truman was wrong. Because of the deepening Cold War, Truman never saw Stalin again. On Monday, August 6, Truman was recrossing the Atlantic aboard the Augusta when he was handed a message over luncheon. It said that an atomic bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima and was successful in all respects. The war against Japan would soon be won. The president said, "This is the greatest thing in history." After a second report declaring complete success, Truman leapt to his feet and told Burns, "It's time for us to get home." 3 days later, on Thursday, August 9, the United States closed its victory over Japan with a second atomic bomb dropped under existing orders on Nagasaki. Emperor Hirohito secretly decided to bear the unbearable, as he said, and meet the Allies' demand for unconditional surrender. But Truman didn't know that yet. That evening, he addressed Americans by radio about his European trip. He told them that the Potsdam Declaration would eliminate Nazism, armaments, war industries, the German General Staff, and all its military tradition. It would hope to rebuild democracy by control of German education, by reorganizing local government and the judiciary, by encouraging free speech, free press, freedom of religion, and the right of labor to organize. German industry, he said, would be decentralized in order to do away with concentration of economic power in cartels and monopolies. Germans would be granted no higher standard of living than their former victims. Truman declared that the wartime Allies were resolved to do what we can to make Germany over into a decent nation and eventually work its way back into the civilized world. Truman's speech largely obscured the unresolved questions and harsh compromises that were the legacy of Potsdam. The Soviets would get reparations, but the victors still had to agree on what. Germany would be treated as an economic whole, but in each zone the commander would have paramount authority. The defeated nation, he suggested, would not be partitioned, and the shift of German land to Poland was merely provisional. As the American diplomat W.R. Smizer wrote in 1999, at Potsdam, each side paid what it had to pay to get what it wanted most. Stalin got almost one quarter of pre-World War II German territory for Poland. Britain and America, by demanding that each victor seize reparations from its own zone, spared post-war Germany the staggering reparations and debt that in the 1920s had brought inflation, unemployment, and Hitler. They had also prepared a means, if necessary, to protect Western Germany from Soviet encroachment. John McCloy knew what was really going on. He knew that if Soviet-American relations deteriorated, the slash between the Soviet and Western zones would become much more than an abstraction. He wrote in his diary, "We are drifting toward a line down the middle of Germany."
The spirit and the soul of a people reborn.
For 3 years after Potsdam, the story of Americans in Germany was not chiefly Harry Truman's, but Lucius Clay's. As with General Douglas MacArthur, his viceroy in Japan, Truman did little to interfere with General Clay's autonomy over the American zone. Clay first read his marching orders, JCS 1067, while flying to Europe in April 1945. He agreed with 1067's premise that Germans bore collective guilt for Hitler's crimes. He wrote McCloy that he was unwilling to concede that Germany became what it was just because Germans were inclined to follow the leader. Clay also approved of the measures to punish German war criminals, arrest high officials, and restrict factories that might make war. But, like Stimson and McCloy, he felt that Americans were not a vindictive people. Clay objected most of all to the part of 1067 that was the most direct legacy of the Morgenthau Plan. After surveying the vast destruction across Germany, Clay wrote McCloy that some hunger was necessary to make Germans realize the consequences of a war which they caused, but not to the point where it results in mass starvation and sickness. In August 1945, Clay moved from Frankfurt to Berlin. He didn't want to strike the Germans as a hedonistic potentate, so he took a modest, ivy-covered house in the suburb of Dahlem. One of his first problems with JCS 1067 was the ban against American fraternization with the Germans. He wrote McCloy, "The only fraternization that really interests the soldiers is going with the pretty German girl, who is very much in evidence." Backed by Marshall and Eisenhower, Clay lifted the ban. He declared that Americans could converse with adult Germans on the streets and in public places. Clay ordered his military government to pursue what he called the four Ds. These were demilitarization, decartelization, democratization, and denazification. As U.S. troops had thrust into Germany, military organizations had been disbanded and arms and ammunition seized. But breaking up cartels would have to be done in concert with the other occupying powers. Clay began his campaign for democracy by ordering that all Nazi textbooks and literature be destroyed. But he noted at the same time, you cannot build real democracy in an atmosphere of distress and hunger. As for denazification, Clay told Washington in July 1945 that he had not yet seen any general feeling of war guilt or repugnance for Nazi doctrine or the Nazi regime. He said the Germans mainly blame the Nazis for losing the war. He said they protest ignorance of the regime's crimes and shrug off their own support or silence as incidental and unavoidable. Clay's denazification program faltered under the immensity of the task, his meager resources, his eagerness to keep the economy running by keeping many local Nazis employed, and also his eagerness to win the contest against the Soviets for German sympathies. But even with its limitations, the U.S. denazification program was more thorough than that of the British or French, and certainly more so than the Soviet. Ultimately, about 3 million Germans were charged, 2 million put on trial, and almost 1 million punished in some fashion. Later on, though, Clay said that his program had been too strict. He said, "I think we carried it too far. The British and French didn't have the same feeling toward the Nazis that we did. Neither one had a huge Jewish population that had developed a hatred you can well understand." Truman asked Byron Price, Roosevelt's wartime censorship director, to visit the U.S. zone in Germany and report on Clay's performance. Price told Truman that many Germans who at first greeted the Americans as liberators were showing surprise and depression at our stern policies of denazification and industrial dismantling. Price also reported widespread surprise among Germans that the Allies had not yet fulfilled their promise to try the highest Nazi leaders by international tribunal. He said this does not improve relations with a German people who traditionally respect only firm and swift authority. The International Tribunal convened at Nuremberg in November 1945. It started with Martin Bormann in absentia and Hermann Göring. In all, 22 high Nazi leaders were indicted for conspiracy to commit war crimes, crimes against the peace, and crimes against humanity. Echoing the arguments of Henry Stimson during the war, Truman recalled in 1963 that he wanted a just, swift, and public trial to show Germans the ineradicable stain their leaders had put on their name among nations, and to make it impossible for anyone ever to say, in times to come, "Oh, it never happened, just a lot of propaganda, a pack of lies." At the same time Clay had to punish the Germans in his zone, he was also charged with attracting them to American-style democracy. To start democratic processes and cut occupation costs, he moved faster than the other occupiers to hand local responsibility to what he called good Germans. In November 1945, he went back to Washington. He was relieved to find that asking to rebuild the German economy no longer risked getting him hanged on the Washington Monument. In the meantime, the provisional French president, Charles de Gaulle, threw sand into the gears of the Allied Control Council. Truman felt that de Gaulle's desire to restore France to world power was fascist or Napoleonic. He had had to threaten de Gaulle with a halt in financial aid to France simply to evict French troops from Stuttgart, which was in the American zone. Troubled by new conflicts with the Soviets, eager to protect France and the Ruhr from communism, Truman began to grow impatient with Clay's soldierly collaboration with the Russians and his insistence on pursuing the Potsdam Agreement to treat Germany as an economic whole. At a meeting of the Council of Foreign Ministers in Moscow at the end of 1945, Jimmy Burns independently offered possible recognition of Soviet-backed regimes in Romania and Bulgaria and issued a public statement on his diplomacy before reporting back to Truman. By Truman's later account, he read aloud to Burns from a complaint he had written him about Burns' insubordination. The letter warned, "Unless Russia is faced with an iron fist and strong language, another war is in the making." Truman said, "I'm tired of babying the Soviets." In the Allied Control Council, Clay told the Soviets in French that he could not keep depleting the U.S. zone for reparations without reaping the gains from economic unification agreed on at Potsdam. He halted industrial dismantling and the reparations deliveries. The Soviets thundered against what they called the illegal General Clay. In May 1946, Clay sent a dark cable to Washington. After a year of occupation, it said, the four German zones had become almost airtight territories. With a deteriorating German economy, failure to get economic unity would make the next winter almost unbearable. The next month, Assistant Secretary of War Robert Patterson wrote Burns that U.S. national security required economic revival of the Ruhr and Rhineland and use of German resources to buttress Western Europe against engulfment by the Soviet Union. Clay warned Burns of the Germans' anxiety that U.S. forces would leave them to confront the Red Army alone. In September 1946, the Secretary of State came to Germany. He spoke at the Stuttgart Opera House to an audience including dozens of the Germans that Clay had appointed in his experiment at self-government. Millions of Germans listened by radio to a simultaneous German translation of the speech. Burns assured the Germans that as long as there were any occupation soldiers in Germany, Americans would stay. He said, "We will not shirk our duty. We are not withdrawing." He said, "The American people want to help the German people to win their way back to an honorable place among the free and peace-loving nations of the world." As Clay later recalled, there was enormous enthusiasm. He said, "It was unbelievable to me. Here was an American Secretary of State out there signing autographs for the Germans little over 1 year after the end of the war." That winter, at Clay's request, Truman sent former President Herbert Hoover to tour Western Germany, using Goering's old private train. On his return, Hoover warned that the economy of the defeated land had sunk to the lowest level in 100 years. In response, the Joint Chiefs of Staff resolved that the complete revival of German industry, particularly coal mining, was now of primary importance to American security. In January 1947, Truman fired Jimmy Burns. Almost immediately, Marshall scrapped JCS 1067 and replaced it with a more generous JCS 1779. The new directive said that an orderly and prosperous Europe requires the economic contributions of a stable and productive Germany. By the spring of 1947, Marshall concluded that more bargaining with the Russians about a united Germany might only open the way for Soviet power. In June 1947, at the Harvard commencement, he unveiled what became known as the Marshall Plan. It offered huge U.S. aid for European recovery. For inspiration while it was being drafted, Marshall had sent for Henry Stimson's private 1944 memos to Roosevelt, lambasting the Morgenthau Plan and demanding the post-war reconstruction of Germany. With the Marshall Plan, Morgenthau's plan for Germany was dead once and for all. He denounced it as a scheme to extend U.S. influence into Eastern Europe, but he could not derail it. Soviet documents opened after the Cold War show that Stalin hoped for a united Germany, but only so long as there remained the chance of lavish reparations. Years later, Molotov admitted that he had tried to expand Soviet frontiers as far as possible. He said that his view was that there could be no peace-loving Germany unless Germany followed the path of socialism. After the failure of another foreign minister's meeting in early 1948, Truman reached a conclusion. He decided that the Russians were not going to carry out their agreement for a four-power commission on Germany. In the 1990s, the historian Carolyn Eisenberg wondered whether the U.S. gave up too fast on the chance for a united Germany that would be genuinely neutral. She felt that the U.S. government avoided potentially favorable bargains with the Soviets because it expected a complete collapse down the road. But gambling on a united Germany in the late 1940s might well have opened the way to a Soviet Europe or a German nation that was eager for another Hitler. Surveys made a decade after the German defeat revealed that most Germans still thought that Germany's best time in recent history had been during the first years of the Nazis. In the same survey, a large minority insisted that Nazism was a good idea badly carried out, and that Hitler was a great German leader. Through all the Big Three bargaining over Germany during World War II, Stalin had kept a potent weapon. This was his ability to block access routes to Berlin, which was 110 miles deep in the Soviet zone. In April 1948, he complained that the West was moving toward a divided Germany. The Soviet government declared that no train should move in or out of Berlin without Soviet inspection and permission. 2 months later, the Americans, British, and French announced a step toward merger of their three zones. The step was creation of a uniform currency that would thwart Soviet policies causing inflation and stalling economic recovery in Western Germany. The Soviets responded by walking out of the Allied Control Commission and claiming all of Berlin. Rail and motor routes from the western zones were shut down. The U.S. Army feared a confrontation. Clay was refused when he asked to test the Soviet blockade of West Berlin by armored convoy. Instead, the British and Americans launched what soon became known as the Berlin Airlift. The Berlin Airlift supplied the citizens of the western sectors of Berlin with up to 8,000 tons of food, coal, and other provisions per day. In his diary, Truman wrote, "We'll stay in Berlin, come what may." Clay and his British and French cohorts also imposed a counter-blockade of steel, equipment, and coal shipments from Western Germany. By the spring of 1949, the Berlin blockade had failed. The British, French, and Americans saw little chance for a united Germany soon. Instead, they prepared for a Western alliance, NATO, and a West German state that would shield Western Europe against the Soviet Union and anchor the West Germans in democracy. Under Adenauer's chairmanship, German leaders were asked to write a charter for a new West German government. To show they did not endorse the lasting division of Germany, they convened at Bonn. Bonn was a city so provincial that it was unlikely to permanently replace Berlin. For the same reason, they called their charter not a constitution, but a basic law. In contrast to the shaky edifice of Weimar Germany that Hitler had pulled down, the basic law barred from the new parliament, paralyzing no-confidence votes and splinter parties. To prevent another Hitler, it placed severe limits on the new chief of state. On May 23, 1949, the Federal Republic of Germany was born. 5 months later, Stalin established his own provisional German Democratic Republic. Stalin's new state was dominated by the brutal security service, later known as the Stasi. The new West German state was modeled on the old pre-Bismarck tradition of small, semi-autonomous lands.